everyone. This is Crystal from the Spooky Barber Babes. Today's episode is basically going to just be a jump right on in. I have done a lot recently with information on multiple cases. There will be episodes coming back out on a weekly basis again. I do apologize for the last year of just lack of content coming out on the regular, just because between kids getting sick and me getting sick and work and life, nobody wants to hear it, so I'm just going to move on. But again, I apologize for my time, but I am now back in the saddle. Hopefully I'll have something lined up with Bray soon, crossing fingers on that. But for today, let's talk about some cases. There have been multiple cases that have just kind of been whirlwinded into WTF territory. There's also been a big update with the Lori Vallow case. As most of you have already know, we have seen the conclusion of her case, but we have not seen the end of Lori Vallow in court. I will be getting back to that shortly. Also, we're going to touch on the Moscow, Idaho murders and just basically a little update with that portion of the case because something crazy happened there too. But there's also a little bit of update with Chad Daybell's case. There might be some movement with that. I'm not too sure. Still reaching out on this. But I also wanted to give you guys an update on half of the cases that I will be doing this month alone. We'll be back to our normal schedule. I keep saying our. I know everybody's like, but Crystal, where's Bree been? Working. We no longer work together. And I think we said that during our last YouTube episode. So we're not really on the same schedule and able to record as much. But I think from now on, Bree might be just with me on YouTube, which is fine. I think it might just be easier for us to sit down and do that later. There's also going to be a secondary channel. This one, I've come to the conclusion that the Spooky Barber Babes page has been 100% just true crime lately. I do have the cartoon conspiracy episodes, but as far as anything else goes on that end, I haven't been doing much of the conspiracy stuff. I have files galore. But everyone that has talked to me about this has talked to me about true crime. So I think we're just going to steer with this strictly as true crime, and that there will be a secondary show underneath the Spooky Barber Babes brand for conspiracy theories leaning from like real world to the cartoon world. Cause you all seem to love when I do the cartoon episodes, but, so those will start coming out a little more frequently. Just haven't decided if I'm going to do it under the same channel and just list it off as something separate, or if I'm just going to start a complete new channel as well. I will get back to you all on that. And also, I have decided that most of the shorter episodes that I record, I'm most likely just going to start posting up the shorter stuff on TikTok, on YouTube, and on Instagram during the reels, make things a little bit easier for everybody because, I mean, yeah, little short stories, they're great, but it's nice to get some actual feedback on certain things. And it seems like everyone loves the history lesson that I've been doing with the last meals over on TikTok. I did take a break just because we are in the U.S. males last meal. And let me tell you something, there are more men in prison on death row or that have been on death row in the United States that it's going to take more than two parts. And I want to try to organize everything before I jump right back into it. Also, instead of doing it with the voiceover, like I have done in the past, I'm actually going to start doing the voices for it. So yeah, look out for that. But before we begin today, no, not an ad from a paid sponsor, but instead, I would love to introduce you to another podcast for spooksters who I love these two, but I'm going to let the girls from They Don't Stay Dead talk to you themselves. In today's episode, we're going to take it all the way back to September 5th of 1934 in Cleveland, Ohio, mainly in Kingsbury Run. Now, Kingsbury Run is a prehistoric riverbed running from the flats along the Cuyahoga River near Lake Erie to East 90th Street. Trains and rapid transit tracks run through this area, and it's bordered on the north by Woodland Ave and on the south by Broadway Ave. And in the 1930s, Kingsbury Run was a dark and very dangerous place to be. Now, because of that, this was around the time of the Great Depression, and Cleveland was hit extremely hard. But during the 1930s, city leaders had worked to help the citizens who were struggling and help raise the community morale. Now, the Great Lakes Exposition and the Republican National Convention were scheduled to be hosted in Cleveland in 1936. But that did happen. But during that time, from 1934 to 1938, something horrible was happening during that time. Now, just to kind of set this in, this large city that was improving economically after the Great Depression was hit with one of the most prolific serial killer that their town or that city had seen. Now, 12 people were brutally murdered over a course of 4 years, but a 13th person was added to this list of victims 2 years, I think, after her death. But the murders ended just as swiftly as they began. And although the safety director at the time, Elliot Ness, had claimed to have solved the crimes, there had been no suspect that was officially identified, and no one was brought to trial. To this day, this murder happens to be one of the most sensationalized and intrigued unsolved crimes in our nation's history. Now, just a little just a little information about the area that I'm going to be talking about, because I'm going to be giving out a lot of details, but I'm also going to reference an area called the Roaring Third a few times. Now, this area is just east of the Run and was known as the Roaring Third police precinct, home to bars, brothels, flophouses, and gambling debts. You can see why that would attract some people. Now, out of this, only two victims were positively identified and their identities confirmed. There is a third victim who was unofficially identified. But again, she was not officially identified. She was unofficially identified. I did see some information that even though, yes, there are 13 murders that can be attested to this, that there is possible that there could be 20 or more. But so far, all I could find on him was him or her. Let's go with that. Him or her was 13. Now, all the victims in this case were decapitated. Most were still alive when they were killed. Now, time to jump into this mess, because I'm going to talk about each individual that had been announced, starting with victim number zero. And I call her victim number zero because this is the woman who was added to the list, to the official kill total, 2 years after being murdered. Now, it would be 1 year after that, like her being added to the kill list, that the case technically would become officially open. The remains of a young woman in her mid-30s were discovered on September 5th, 1934. Her body had washed up on the shores of Lake Erie east of Bratnall. The torso still had legs attached, but both legs had been amputated at the knees. The Cuyahoga County Coroner, A.J. Pierce, noted a chemical preservative on the skin that had turned it red, tough, and leathery. A subsequent search yielded other body parts, but her head was never found. Being as though she was never identified and wasn't added to the kill list until years later, she became known as the Lady of the Lake. Again, she was never identified, and her head still remains unfound. Our next victim came later in September of 1935. 1 year later, precisely. I don't know exactly the date because it didn't really give me a date. But there were two teenage boys who had discovered the decapitated and emasculated corpse of a white male at the base of Jackass Hill, where East 49th Street dead ends into Kingsbury Run. The naked body, aside from socks, was clean, drained of blood with rope burns around the wrists on both arms. Cause of death? Decapitation. He is one of two victims who has been positively identified, with fingerprints identifying him as 28-year-old Edward Andrassy. He frequented the Roaring Third. Keep his name in mind because that's going to come up a little later. Victim number two was also found on the same day that victim number one was found. Police were doing a search for more body pieces in Edward's crime scene when body number two was discovered decapitated and emasculated as well. It also seemed to be covered in the same chemical preservative as the Lady of the Lake. Now, I'm going to say this. I don't think the chemical preservative was found on all the bodies, but the body was believed to be a white male in his 40s and had to appeared to have been dead for a couple weeks. Again, he was never identified. Victim number three, January of 1936, a woman's remains were discovered neatly wrapped in newspaper and packed in two half bushel baskets. The baskets were left on the side of the Hart Manufacturing Building off Central Ave near East 20th Street. The rest of the remains, minus the head, were discovered 10 days later in a vacant lot on Orange Ave. Cause of death was decapitation. However, the killer waited for full rigor mortis to kick in before disarticulating the rest of the body. Cleveland PD used fingerprints to ID her as Florence Polillo. I don't know, you probably don't pronounce it that way, but anyways. She was a barmaid and a waitress who lived at East 32nd Street and Carnegie, right on the edge of the Roaring Third. I'm assuming that also means that she worked in the Roaring Third. On June of 1936, 6 months after victim number three was discovered, victim number four was found early in the morning in Kingsbury Run. Two young boys had discovered a head of a white male wrapped in trousers and I can't read my own writing. This sucks. The head was wrapped in trousers near the East 55th Bridge. The next day, the body of 20-something-year-old man was dumped in front of the Nickel Plate Railroad Police Building. It was clean and drained of blood, and the corpse was intact minus the head. Again, COD was decapitation. I'm assuming because there's no difference between this because there's no statement if the head that they found wrapped in the trousers and the body were the same. I'm assuming they were, and the reason I assume is because they had fresh prints and six distinctive tattoos on the body, but police were unable to get a positive ID on the man. There is a plaster reproduction of the man's head and a diagram of the kind and location of the tattoos that were on display at the 1936 Great Lake Exposition. Over 100,000 people saw the death mask, and yet he was still unidentified. The original death mask and three others from this case are on display in the Cleveland Police Museum, which I have to say, I kind of want to go there just so I can see that myself, because I'm weird. I'm weird like that. This stuff intrigues me. But that's what makes me think that the head and the body belong together, or at least they're assuming the head and the body go together, because it wasn't registered as two separate victims. But who knows? I mean, it could have been two separate victims. You know, everything I found didn't say anything about that. So anyways, I'm rambling. Victim number five came 1 month later in July of 1936, and the remains of a 40-year-old white male, who, again, you guessed it, was decapitated, were found in the woods near Clinton Road and Big Creek, west side of Cleveland. He had been dead for roughly 2 months. His head, along with a pile of clothes, were found nearby, and there was an enormous amount of blood on the ground where he was found, and police pretty much assumed that that is where he was killed. He was never identified. So victim number six came in September of 1936. And in the fall of 1936, there's a lot that kind of happens that I'm going to get into after I discuss victim number six. A man had tripped over the upper half of a male torso while trying to hop a train at East 37th Street in Kingsbury Run. Cleveland PD searched a, quote, pool, which was basically just an open sewer, just really big. The lower half of the torso, along with parts of the legs, were recovered by a diver in that open sewer. More than 600 onlookers came to watch the spectacle, and it is believed that there was a possibility the killer could have been a part of those onlookers. Cause of death? Decapitation again. He was believed to be in his late 20s, and Coroner Pierce noted the lack of hesitation marks in the disarticulation of the body, which indicated someone very familiar with human anatomy and a strong, confident killer. He also noted that the victim died instantly when the head was severed in one heavy, clean cut. Victim number six was never identified. But in the fall of 1936, the media had a frenzy with this. It was the Cleveland Press, the Cleveland News, and the Cleveland Plain Dealer had all reported daily on the killings and the lack of suspects. Headlines reading, six brutal killings in 1 year and no clues nor suspects. To say tension was high is an understatement. Mayor Harold Burton had pressured the police department, and the newly appointed safety director, Elliot Ness, got more involved in the case due to this pressure. Dubbed a torso clinic, Coroner Pierce had called for a meeting with himself, police, and other experts in this area to discuss and create a profile for the killer based off of the information that they had. Now, detectives Peter Marilow and Martin Zaleski were put undercover on the case kind of full time. When they weren't on active duty, they dressed like those living down in the Run and the Roaring Third and went and interviewed more than 1,500 people. The department as a whole had interviewed more than 5,000 people in this case. It's known as the largest police investigation in Cleveland history. And by the November elections, Mayor Harold Burton was retained as the mayor, but sadly, Coroner Pierce was replaced by Samuel Gerber, whose fierce dedication to medicine and his law degree had put him at the forefront of the investigation. Well, you guessed it. Another murder happens, but this murder doesn't happen for 4 months. In February of 1937, victim number seven was washed upon the shore east of Brattonall, and it was the upper half of a woman's torso. However, her COD was not decapitation. She had already been dead before being split. Her lower half was found 3 months later at about East 30th. She was in her mid-20s and never identified. Victim number eight came 4 months later, in June of 1937. A human skull and a burlap bag full of skeletal remains were found under Lorraine Carnegie Bridge. Now, remember when I said that there were some remains that were unofficially identified? These remains were unofficially identified as petite black woman Rose Wallace, who was about 40. Police had followed all leads they had on her, but came up empty. Her way of them unofficially IDing her was through dental records. And I'm assuming, like, dental work records weren't as easy to confirm. So without any skin, it was just skeletal remains. So there was no fingerprints for them to find. Now, victim number 9 came, again, 1 month later in July of 1937. There were labor problems in the flat that summer. Therefore, the National Guard had been called in to maintain order. And a young guardsman on watch on West 3rd Street saw the first piece of victim number 9 in the river in the wake of a tugboat. Over the next several days, the body was recovered, all except the head. But a new element was added to the profile, as the abdomen had been gutted and the heart had been ripped out, showing a new level of viciousness to the killer. This unidentified male was in his mid to late 30s and again was never identified. Victim number 10 comes to us in April of 1938. Victim number 10's legs were found by a woman laborer, by a young laborer on his way to work in the flats. It was the lower half of a woman's leg. 1 month later, police pulled 2 burlap bags out of the river containing both parts of the torso and most of the remains of both legs. For the first time, Coroner Gerber detected drugs in the system, but since no arms were found, it is uncertain if the drugs were from the killer or if the victim had an addiction of her own. Again, not identified. Now, victim number 11 and 12 were found on August 16th in 1938. 3 scrap collectors were looking around a dump site at East 9th and Lakeside and found the torso of a woman wrapped in a man's double-breasted blue blazer and then wrapped again in an old quilt. The legs and arms were discovered in a makeshift box wrapped in brown butcher paper and held together with rubber bands. The head had been similarly wrapped. I cannot talk. Gerber noted some of the parts looked like they were refrigerated. While searching for more parts, police discovered the remains of a second body only a few yards away. Neither victim was identified. However, pretty sure this was a taunt, because both bodies had been placed in a location in plain view of Elliot Ness's office window. So this guy was just like, I'm going to do this right in front of you and you're not going to see me. Sadly, because of this, on August 18th, 2 days after the last 2 bodies were discovered, Ness and a group of 35 officers and detectives raided the homeless encampments in Kingsbury Run. 11 squad cars, 2 police vans, and 3 fire trucks descended on the large section of makeshift shacks where the river twists behind the public square. Raiders had gathered up roughly 63 men. After searching the shacks by order of the safety director, the shacks were set on fire and burned to the ground. Now, the press and the public had criticized Ness's actions. Many were frustrated, saying the raid did nothing to stop or solve the murders, and it was pointless to do. In July of 1939, County Sheriff Martin O'Donnell arrested 52-year-old Bohemian bricklayer Frank Dolezal for the murder of Flo Polillo. Now, remember how I told you to keep Edward in your brain? Well, this is where the connection comes in. Dolezal lived with Polillo literally for a brief time. An investigation later revealed his acquaintance with not only Edward Andrassy, but Rose Wallace. His, quote, confession, however, was basically filled with the ramblings of, I don't want to say an uneducated man, because I don't know if he was uneducated or not, but it was clearly illegible, undetermined, except for the details of the case were precisely written down as if he was coached on what to write down. And it is believed that he was coached into what he was saying. Now, however, before he could go on trial, the 5'8" Dolezal had somehow managed to kill himself by hanging from a hook only 5'7" off the floor. Gerber's autopsy revealed 6 broken ribs, all which had been obtained while in sheriff's custody. Now, to this day, few believe that Frank Dolezal was the torso killer. And truth be told, I have a feeling that he was actually killed and that it was, I don't want to say that it was done by police or if it was done by inmates, but my thing is, I just gray murder, and that they were just kind of saying, oh, look, the killer died. That's why there's no more. But although there was no official arrest on, or real suspect, like I said, the only person that they quote unquote arrested and, was just, yeah. Anyways, Elliot Neese had a suspect that he believed was undoubtedly the killer, which was not Frank. This suspect continued to taunt Ness long after the murders had stopped. And this person went by the name Mysterious Dr. X. He was investigated and interrogated for 1 week by Elliot Ness and other experts, but did not confess. It is believed that Dr. X, it was Dr. Francis E. Sweeney, an intelligent, skilled, and very troubled surgeon who lived near Kingsbury Run. Now, there was no physical evidence linking him to the crimes, so Sweeney was let go. Now, however, after 1 week long of interrogation by Ness and the others, he committed himself to a sanatorium, and they assumed that, since the murder stopped, that's who it was. So they basically put 2 people on blast. One person killed themselves. One person, I would say killed themselves in, quotations, because, yeah. And then the other one, committed himself to a sanatorium because he was already troubled. We don't know what happened inside that interrogation room, what methods were used. But ironically about all of this is that all official police records on this case have been either lost, destroyed, or, quote, removed. So my thing is, you have this big case, and looking up information, I'm assuming they really, since there's nothing for them to use, they can't go back and do DNA analysis. But I mean, you think they would be able to go back now, exhume the bodies like they did for the boy in the box. I mean, look what they were able to do with him. And he was killed, in the 60s? So who knows what they could do for people that were killed in the 30s. Maybe there might still be some DNA in the bones that they could get that might be able to help figure out, find a descendant or something, if there is, or other family, or just give us an idea of who these people were. But sadly, with nothing to go by, I guess we're just stuck sitting here going, guess there's nothing, which really sucks. But the amount of things I've seen, and it's interesting because I typed in torso killer, and I guess I should have been a little bit more specific when I started this, because I didn't realize how many torso killers there were. Apparently there was a lot of people listed for as torso killer. You have Richard Cottingham. He was, I guess, known as that as well, because when I typed in the torso killer, he popped right up for me. But I'll be doing that. I'll be doing a case on Richard Cottingham later. But as of right now, his case was all in New York City in the 1970s. So you're talking roughly a little less than 40 years later. But anyways, he was known as the torso killer of New York City. He, if I'm correct, is in jail or was in jail.
Not too sure if he's... Yeah, I think he's still alive. Anyways, this killer, Cleveland's torso murderer, also known as the Mad Butcher of Kingsbury Run, is unidentified. Has been unidentified, will never be apprehended. He's probably dead and got away with it. And I hate to say it like that, but it's the truth. But my biggest wonder is, okay, there's heads. You've only found, I think, what, three heads? I think three or four. And you're going to tell me that you couldn't identify those either? But again, not a lot of arms. But my other thing is, you're saying that this man had, or woman, and I keep saying man because I have a strong feeling that it was a guy, because you don't hear much about women killers like to that extent. And the way that they describe the profile that he had, this person had to be super strong. But I'm also wondering how stable this person was. But who knows? You know, this person could have been completely mentally stable and could have just been experimenting, which is horrible to say. But the main thing that I'm looking at with this case is that there's probably no way that those unidentified victims will be able to ever have their identification made. And I don't want to say, you know, spotty police work with, you know, keeping the records, but how do you lose a case, like case files? And we're not talking about, on like one killer. No, on one victim. We're talking like 13 bodies, and you're going to say everything's just lost or destroyed. Why? Why was it destroyed? How did it get lost? Was something being covered up? Did they find something that they didn't want out? You know, no disparaging on the police force from back then, but I know there wasn't as much gadgets and gizmos that we have now. But I'm pretty sure, like, if we went in and there was, like, some type of DNA from those cases that were still on file, that we could figure something out. I mean, we've come so far with technology that we've given names to, you know, multiple people. I mean, we have Princess Doe from, I think that was Dawn Olenek was her, I think, her name. And she was Dawn Olenek. She was identified shortly after the boy in the box. And that's, you know, that was what, a couple months ago? I think, don't mind me, I'm looking up to make sure I can get my timeline thing down, when they actually gave him his name back. I want to say it was Joseph Augustus Zarelli. Yep, so that was back in December was when we got his name. And then shortly afterwards, you know, or around that time, we got Dawn Olenek and found out that, holy crap, you know, we now have a name for her. I think there's also another child who was just found that she was found obviously years ago. She was unknown and we just found her identity. So, I mean, if you can find all these cases and get IDs for all these other people, why can't we go back into the old case files and try to, like, exhume those bodies? Where are they buried? Where were they kept? Were they just discarded? Doesn't say. And I know I'm getting really, like, heated about this. I'm stuttering because I'm getting heated, which is, yeah. But my biggest thing is, like, we've come so far, and I would love to actually get an update on, hey, is there, like, I know a statute of limitations has already passed. I know the person that probably committed these murders is gone, you know, has probably left this earth probably years ago. But this person got away with it. And my biggest thing is, Did the person have family? Were they married? Did they have kids? If so, where do they put the heads? Did they keep the heads as mementos, or did they do something with the heads? You know, did they have like a secret storage unit somewhere in the middle of nowhere where they kept all the pieces that they kept? And I don't know. My brain always wonders about those kind of things, like, where's the rest of them? So, anyways, that's it for me tonight. My brain's exploding. And yes, I say it tonight because I am recording late at night again. But yeah, that's it for me. My brain is going to continue to go ponder these things and not rant for another 10 minutes about what I think should happen. But like I said, I will be doing an episode on Richard Cottingham soon. I will also be finishing up the Last Meals, the USA Men's series over the next month and a half. I will also be discussing a couple conspiracy theories coming up. Some people were telling me not to dive into Aaron Hernandez and Chris Benoit, but I do true crime and conspiracy theories, and both have been littered with conspiracy theories since. And Chris Benoit is definitely, you know, it's true crime. There's also the other one that I wanted to talk about, was the Tylenol murders. Well, not really. Yeah, Tylenol murders. And then also next week, there will be an airing of the Vending Machine Killer, aka the Parakeet Murders, from Japan around 1985. So stick around, stay tuned for next week's episode. And as always, stay spooky, everybody.